Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for May 15th. I'm your volunteer reader, Jack Palmer, and in this hour we'll be reading headlines, Valiant State, and USA Today headlines. The first article is entitled, Hobbs Seeks United Front on Arizona's Share of Colorado River Water. Arizona is doing its part and taking its hits to conserve the Colorado River, Governor Katie Hobbs said, and it's time for upstream states to do the same. The governor assembled a roundtable of water users and officials on May 13th to present what she called a unified front among the state's interests in defending Arizona's share of the Colorado River as time runs short for reaching a deal with other states that use the water. So far, states upstream from Arizona have not offered cutbacks beyond the limits that a paltry snowpack naturally extracts from their farmers. It's been more than a little frustrating, Hobbs said. We've come to the table with real solutions, with real proposals. We have real skin in the game, she said, including billions of dollars in water infrastructure upgrades and in conservation agreements that keep the water in the river's reservoirs. The upper states need to be willing to take their share as well. Gathered at Central Arizona Project headquarters with representatives of cities, tribes, farms, and hydropower interests, all reliant on the river water that flows into the CAP's canal, Hobbs said the state seeks a compromise. Otherwise, supplies could become subject to litigation, an outcome she said she's preparing for, in part, by seeking a legal fund from legislators. We need a signal that we're prepared to defend our water, and that's a strong signal, Hobbs said. As the West has warmed and dried, the river that seven states and Mexico share has shrunk. It's a reality that has already brought significant supply cuts to Arizona in particular, and that the states and federal government are trying to address with a new storage sharing deal that must be in place by the time the old one expires next year. U.S. Interior Department officials seek to publish a draft of the plan by summer, though it's unclear if the states will be able to agree on something by then or will simply wait to see what federal officials envision. So far, the Rocky Mountain states known collectively as the Upper Basin have declined to specify new cuts they might take because they say they already suffered the consequences of a reduced snowpack that shortchanges their farmers every year. The federal government has paid some lower basin farmers and others to cut back on their demands from Lake Mead's storage bank and the four upper basin states of Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming argue that their year-in, year-out hardship is unrewarded and largely invisible to water users in the Southwest. Those states were slower to develop water that the 1922 Colorado River Compact envisioned for them, and therefore continue to use less even as an age of aridification has threatened their ability to send the lower basin its compact prescribed share each year. We have hydrologic shortage every year across all four states, Colorado River's Commissioner Becky Mitchell said at a February meeting of the Upper Colorado River Commission. These are forced cuts based on administration of water rights that are not compensated. Presented with that viewpoint, Hobbs rejected the claims that the Upper Basin is doing its part. That's water on paper, the governor said. It's not real water. We're putting real water on the table, and they're not, feeling any impact based on the system changes. Recognizing that the lower basin, Arizona, California, and Nevada use more of the water, those states have together proposed absorbing the first 1.5 million acre-feet of new cuts, enough water to support millions of households. But they want the upper basin to agree to share equally in any further cuts that might be necessary to keep the river flowing past Glen Canyon and Hoover Dam in especially dry years. Arizona's full allocation of Colorado River water, including on-river uses such as Yuma Farms, is 2.8 million acre-feet. It is second to California's 4.4 million acre-feet. So far, the Upper Basin has not agreed to send more water, and the former Biden administration did not include that option in the alternatives it began analyzing before leaving office. Arizona Water Resources Director Tom Buschatsky said Trump administration officials appear ready to help reach a collaborative agreement. Because the previous administration's initial approach did not suggest obvious risk of new cuts for the Upper Basin, he said, it may have reduced incentives to deal. Discussions with Interior officials now suggest that they are more willing to tweak alternatives in a way that could prod collaboration. This administration is taking more of the tack that we asked for, which is to show risk for both basins, Buschatsky said. The two basins continued to talk, but he said he could not rate the chances of reaching a deal this summer. The Central Arizona Project has already absorbed a reduction of nearly a third of its normal entitlement to the river, partly from voluntary conservation measures and partly because the expiring storage sharing agreement lumped the first steep cuts on Arizona. Those mandated cuts reflect the lower priority that the state accepted decades ago in its efforts to secure federal authorization for CAP. CAP Board President Terry Goddard told the Arizona Republic that what's left is critical to the region's health and the U.S. commitment to tribal water rights. He said he doubts it would be legal to further reduce canal flows to those users in the Phoenix and Tucson areas. Besides seeking conservation in other states, he said, it could be necessary to shift some of Arizona's next cuts to the Yuma area, which generally has older, superior water rights. Whether by cooperation or eventual emergency legislation, he said, it will be necessary to spread the pain. It's a time of shortage, and everybody's going to pay the price, Goddard said. We've already paid ours. Tribes including the Tohono O'odham, Ak-Chin, and Gila River Indian community attended the roundtable and said they have collaborated with cities and others to keep water in Lake Mead, and now it's incumbent on the United States to keep water flowing to them through the CAP canal. Ak-Chin Chairman Gabriel Lopez said the Colorado is his tribe's only reliable source for irrigating its 16,000 acres of farms. The U.S. granted the water in a 1978 settlement meant to make up for other users' depletion of the groundwater that previously supported the community, he said, and is a sacred trust. Tribes like us hold senior water rights, Lopez said. We expect these sacred and good faith obligation agreements to be honored. Phoenix and Tucson officials noted that they have dramatically reduced per capita use over decades, and in recent years struck deals to keep some of their water in Lake Mead, a case that other cities around the watershed can also make. A representative from the Arizona Power Authority said low water kept Hoover Dam from generating a third of its contracted power last year, driving up prices for replacement power. An attorney for Pinal County Farm Groups said their conversion to groundwater as a replacement for previous CAP cuts will be in jeopardy if there is no base fall in the canal to help move the groundwater to where it's needed. The economic development group Valley Partnership said it's the certainty surrounding CAP water that has allowed Phoenix and its ascendant semiconductor industry to thrive. Hobbs agreed and said computer chip manufacturing in the area makes Arizona's water security a national priority. Our growing economy is not just important to Arizona, but it is important to the nation's economy, to national security, to moving manufacturing back to America, Hobbs said. This conversion isn't just about Arizona, it's about our country. The next article is entitled A New Direction, written by Russ Wiles. If Ted Geisler was a bit more committed to becoming a veterinarian, Arizona's largest electric utility would have a different CEO today. Back in 2001, the Phoenix native had recently graduated with a bachelor's degree in veterinary science from Colorado State University, but had lingering doubts as to whether that was the right occupation for him. A mentor suggested he take a pause and try working in another industry. Geisler agreed and landed an entry-level grunt job as a project coordinator on a construction site for Arizona Public Service. The pause turned into a 24-year climb up the corporate ladder, all the way to the top, with Geisler taking the reins as CEO, president, and chairman of both APS and holding company Pinnacle West Capital Corporation. He previously served as APS's president. At 46, Geisler is one of the youngest CEOs of a major corporation in Arizona. Along the way, Geisler learned the utility business while working in many areas of the company, including public policy, nuclear energy, customer relations, business strategy, electricity transmission and distribution, and investor relations. While not an expert in all of those areas, Geisler said he nevertheless was willing to take on new responsibilities and learn the job. Once you overcome the fear of taking on a challenge that you're not fully prepared for, it means you're entering an opportunity for growth. I would charge ahead, he said during an interview at APS's main operations center in North Phoenix. At the end of the day, it's about how you lead and support people, rather than how much technical knowledge you might or might not have. Geisler, who also earned an MBA at Arizona State University, terms his management style as servant leadership and insists that he works for the APS and Pinnacle West teams, not the other way around. He also sees himself as something of a cheerleader for Arizona as it enters a new chapter of economic development and rising energy demand. He considers reasonably priced electricity that's available and reliable as critical to the state's progress. He cited the sprawling Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Complex in North Phoenix within APS's service territory as a prime example. The chip-making company decided to build a cutting-edge factory after 7 years of visits and negotiations with civic and community leaders here. TSMC's initial $12 billion one-factory commitment has since expanded to 6 factories and other facilities totaling $165 billion, placing Phoenix in the middle of the technology race. Power reliability and affordability mattered a lot to them and their customers, Geisler said of TSMC. It was one of the key reasons they selected Phoenix. He expressed confidence that APS can meet the considerably higher energy demand envisioned for Metro Phoenix and the other areas it serves with a diversified mix of fuel sources. The company is closing coal-fired plants despite President Trump's recent call to burn more coal, but will continue to lean on natural gas as it brings more solar power online along with battery storage complexes. We need a substantial amount of new power infrastructure to support growth, Geisler said. APS now has facilities under construction capable of supplying 9,800 megawatts of additional power, he said. That's more than the peak electric demand of around 8,200 megawatts that APS met last summer. The company projects a higher peak use this year of 8,500 or so megawatts. APS also operates the nuclear-powered Palo Verde Generating Station in the far west valley, and Geisler sees a promising future for smaller, modular nuclear reactors in perhaps 15 years. He sits on the executive committee of the Nuclear Energy Institute, a group of companies that operate nuclear power plants around the country. The Pinnacle West Board cited Geisler's role in building relationships with key stakeholders and improving the company's and APS's reputation with customers and regulators. We've watched Ted grow over the years and continue to be impressed with his business acumen and his leadership skills, the board said in a letter marking the appointment, which took effect April 1st. He is focused on doing what is right for our shareholders, customers, and Arizona. Geisler took over for retiring Jeff Guldner, whom the board called an exceptional CEO. Geisler said he spends about one-third of each day dealing with long-term expansion projects. He spends another third meeting with employees and another third representing the company with various stakeholders. For example, he chairs the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry and sits on the board of Greater Phoenix Leadership and the Greater Phoenix Economic Council. APS supplies power to 1.4 million homes in 11 of Arizona's 15 counties, and Geisler said he enjoys visiting rural areas of the state, meeting with APS employees in these areas and local community leaders. While he abandoned the veterinarian route, Geisler has a rural bent in that he enjoys working with horses. He's a volunteer trainer at Huncapi, a Scottsdale farm that uses therapy horses to help people with autism, addictions, and various maladies. As a monopoly regulated by the Arizona Corporation Commission, APS receives its share of criticism, ranging from bills that some ratepayers feel are too high to emissions that environmentalists consider excessive. Sandy Barr, director of Sierra Club's Grand Canyon chapter, said she wonders if APS under Geisler will remain committed to its goal of reducing carbon emissions at the Four Corners coal-burning plant in New Mexico, and she questions some of the legislation the company has been backing. That includes a securitization bill that critics contend would allow the company to bypass some commission oversight in setting rates. Diane E. Brown, executive director of the Arizona Public Interest Research Group Education Fund, urges Geisler to put ratepayers before shareholders and direct top management to regularly and meaningfully engage with stakeholders. She hopes he will continue to meet with consumer advocates to listen and learn about their firsthand experiences with APS customers. Geisler emphasized that APS will face hefty capital needs in coming years as the utility expands its generating capacity. Also, he noted that APS doesn't recoup costs through higher rates approved by the Corporation Commission until after the company has made those investments, often several years later. APS got a black eye recently when media reports revealed the body of Kate Corman, an 82-year-old woman, was found 6 days after APS shut off her power during hot temperatures last year. Medical examiners found that heat stress contributed to her death, and her injuries came from exposure to elevated temperatures. The cause of her accidental death was attributed to complications from chronic alcoholism. The date of her death was not reported. APS said it tried 10 times to contact the Sun City West woman, who had various health problems. The company met its regulatory obligations and internal procedures for dealing with this type of situation, Geisler said. Still, Arizona's Attorney General Chris Mays recently asked the commission to investigate what she calls Arizona's inadequate disconnection policies. Geisler vowed to look for ways to improve its processes for shutting off power on hot days, calling the situation a learning opportunity. In response to a general question of dealing with criticism on various fronts, Geisler said, "The heartbeat of APS is the 6,300 women and men who show up every day, sometimes risking their lives to serve Arizona. All of our team members are dedicated to the prosperity of this state." In a testament to its emphasis on safety, the company said no APS employees died or suffered serious injuries while on the job last year. The next article is entitled, "Syria Urged to Establish Ties with Israel," written by Graham Slattery, Pesha Magid, and Andrew Mills. President Donald Trump met with Syria's president in Saudi Arabia on May 14th and urged him to normalize ties with longtime foe Israel after a surprise announcement that the United States would lift all sanctions against the Islamist-led government. Trump met Syria's Ahmad al-Sharaa, who once pledged allegiance to al-Qaeda and swept power at the head of a group that Washington has called a terrorist organization, before a summit between the United States and Gulf Arab countries. Trump urged Sharaa to join the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Morocco, which normalized relations with Israel under the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords in 2020, the White House press secretary posted on X. Trump said he thought Syria would join at some point, according to a Washington Post pool report. "I think they have to get themselves straightened up. I told him, 'I hope you're going to join when it's straightened out.' He said yes, but they have a lot of work to do," Trump said. Photos posted on Saudi state television showed them shaking hands in the presence of Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Trump's Middle East trip has fueled doubts in Israel about where the company stands in Washington's priorities. The United States exploring the possibility of normalizing ties with Syria, one of Israel's biggest long-standing foes, and holding nuclear talks with its other enemy, Iran, has sidelined Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his government allies. Israel considers Iran's nuclear program an existential threat and does not trust Syria's Islamist president. Despite concerns within sectors of his own administration over Syrian leaders' former ties to al-Qaeda, Trump said on Tuesday he would lift sanctions on Syria in a major policy shift. Israel remains deeply suspicious of Shiraz's administration, and Israeli officials have continued to describe Shiraz as a jihadist, though he severed ties with al-Qaeda in 2016. The Israeli Prime Minister's office did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Trump, who said his Gulf region trip does not sideline Israel, told reporters the fact he has good relations with countries in the Middle East is very good for Israel. He said the meeting with Shiraz, whom he described as a young, attractive guy with a very strong past, was great. "He's got a real shot at holding it together," Trump said. Shiraz was for years the leader of al-Qaeda's official wing in the Syrian conflict. He first joined the group in Iraq, where he spent 5 years in a U.S. prison. The United States removed a $10 million bounty on his head in December. Washington also hopes regional heavyweight Saudi Arabia will join the Abraham Accords, but discussions came to a halt after the Gaza war erupted, and the kingdom insists there can be no normalization without Palestinian statehood. The decision to lift sanctions is a boost for Shiraz, who has been struggling to bring the country under the control of the government after toppling former President Bashar Assad in December. Removing barriers that cut Syria off from the global financial system will clear the way for greater engagement by humanitarian organizations and will ease foreign investment and trade as the country rebuilds from a civil war. Saudi Arabia's foreign minister, Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud, told a news conference that there are many investment opportunities in Syria and Riyadh will support its economic recovery. Israel, which counts the United States as its strongest ally, opposes sanctions relief for Syria and has escalated military strikes there since Assad was toppled, saying it will not tolerate an Islamist presence in southern Syria. The challenges facing Syria's new government were also laid bare in March when Assad loyalists assailed government forces, prompting attacks in which Islamist gunmen killed hundreds of civilians from the Alawite minority, drawing U.S. condemnation. The Syrian foreign minister said May 14th that the meeting between Trump and Shiraz included discussions about combating terrorism and cooperation in eliminating the influence of armed groups that threaten Syrian stability, including the Islamic State. Trump's first day of a four-day swing through the Gulf region brought a $600 billion commitment from Saudi Arabia to invest in the United States and $142 billion in U.S. arms sales to the kingdom. Trump then flew to the Qatari capital Doha, which is also expected to announce hundreds of billions of dollars in investments in the United States. Trump isolated Qatar in 2017 when he lent initial support to a trade and diplomatic embargo that Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt imposed on Doha, one of the worst crises Qatar had ever faced. This is the first visit to Qatar by a U.S. president in 23 years. You're listening to Hour One of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article titled "Skillicorn Charged After Hit and Run," written by Lauren DeYoung. Embattled Fountain Hills Councilmember Alan Skillicorn has been accused of a hit and run, the latest in a series of legal woes that have plagued him since his election in 2022. According to criminal charges filed in Tempe Municipal Court, Skillicorn fled the scene of a crash that damaged property and did not inform anyone of the accident. It was unknown what happened before, during, and after the March 4th crash. The charges were not filed until more than a month later, on April 23rd. Skillicorn declined to comment other than to say, "It's not going to be much of a story." His lawyer, Zachary Ansel, did not reply to requests for comment. Skillicorn's time in the Fountain Hills Town Council has been rocky ever since he took office. He had 6 ethics complaints filed against him and was found in violation of the council's code of ethics by a third-party law firm in 2024. Alan refuses to take responsibility for Alan's actions, rival council member Brenda Kalavinyakis said. So the fact that he would flee an accident scene fits right in line with other things I've noticed about his character. Kalavinyakis was one of 2 council members to file ethics complaints against Skillicorn in 2024. Skillicorn was a state lawmaker in Illinois, where he also faced an ethics violation. A local news outlet alleged he voted for bills while out of town, but an investigator found no evidence that Skillicorn had knowingly allowed anyone to cast a vote for him. One ethics complaint against Skillicorn centered on his interaction with Fountain Hills Code Enforcement Officer Pete Lucchese. In September of 2023, Lucchese reported he was being aggressively followed by Skillicorn after Lucchese removed Skillicorn's political signs for being in violation of city codes. In another, the complaint flagged comments that Skillicorn made at a council meeting, repeatedly asking other council members if they had private conversations with or received campaign funds from a developer who proposed a controversial project. The investigating law firm found he was in violation of 4 ethics codes for his actions in both incidents. After the conclusion of the ethics investigation, the council voted in March 2024 to sanction Skillicorn, barring him from the council's vice mayor position, removing tax dollar funding for him to participate in meetings and events, and mandating he have a chaperone anytime he interacts with a town employee in person. In April 2025, the council voted to remove the sanctions against Skillicorn. During the vote, many council members expressed that Skillicorn had served his time and that it's time to move on, Mayor Gary Friedel said. The procedure of these sanctions was completely unprecedented, completely outside of the norm, Vice Mayor Hannah Toth said. Never have we voted to not allow someone to be vice mayor, to not allow them to have meetings with staff without a babysitter. Many residents were outraged that the council decided to lift the sanctions against Skillicorn. Beth Culp, who has lived in the town for 9 years, said she collected more than 300 signatures from residents on a petition urging leaders to keep the sanctions. "I ask you, please, change the sanctions, modify the sanctions, but he's going to go out and say, 'I won, I won,'" Culp said. She authored 2 ethics complaints against Skillicorn in 2024, both of which investigators dismissed. Kalbianakis and Peggy McMahon voted against the motion, with McMahon saying her vote was a big nay. Skillicorn recused himself from the vote. During the same meeting, the council voted 5-2 to trim the council's code of ethics from 10 subsections to 4. They also approved a motion to eliminate the public's ability to lodge an ethics complaint against the council members. Kalbianakis, as well as McMahon, faced pending ethics complaints at the time of the vote. Friedel also had a pending ethics claim against him. "I voted kind of against my own interest to keep that part of the statute in the code in place, to give people an address of grievances for behavior," Kalbianakis said, noting that she had 15 ethics complaints filed against her, all of which were dismissed. Residents expressed a range of views to the council. Some supported maintaining the ethics code to hold elected leaders accountable, while others called it a waste of time and money and something used as a weapon. Still others suggested scrapping it. "We should not be stripping elected representatives who were elected by the thousands of people in any town in this state of their abilities to serve, or diminishing their abilities to serve," said Elijah Norton, a former treasurer for the state Republican Party and now candidate for state treasurer. If you miss any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then On Demand. We'll continue with an article titled, "Hobbs Kills Pronoun School Bathroom Bills Again." A trio of GOP culture war policy proposals that targeted transgender children in Arizona have, again, met Governor Katie Hobbs' veto stamp. Hobbs, a Democrat, vetoed the bills on May 12th, continuing her defense of the state's LGBTQ+ community. Her vetoes were expected. She has previously killed similar measures in each of her first 2 years as governor. Hobbs vetoed each bill with the same message: "This bill will not increase opportunity, security, or freedom for Arizonans," she wrote. "I encourage the legislature to join me in prioritizing legislation that will lower costs, protect the border, create jobs, and secure our water future." Republicans who supported the bills said they were necessary to protect Arizona children and give parents a say in critical health decisions. But Democrats and advocacy groups warned they were discriminatory and could isolate children, jeopardizing their mental health. Senate Bill 1002 banned school employees or contractors from using pronouns that differ from a student's biological sex or a name other than what was on the student's official record. The bill allowed exceptions if requested by parents in writing. The Arizona Accommodations for All Children Act, or Senate Bill 1003, would have limited school bathrooms and changing rooms to students based on their biological sex. Both bills were sponsored by Fountain Hills Republican Senator John Kavanaugh and were reprisals of similar policies that have met Hobbs's veto stamp. Kavanaugh said in a statement after the recent pair of vetoes that Hobbs continues to defy common sense with her unwavering support for woke ideology that harms Arizona children and violates parental rights. The Democratic governor also scrapped a bill that would have exposed doctors and healthcare workers who perform a gender transition procedure on a minor to lawsuits. Arizona in 2022 was the third state in the nation to pass a law banning gender-related surgery for people under 18. That was signed by former Governor Doug Ducey, a Republican, over the objections of advocacy groups that warned of mental health harms. This year's Senate Bill 1586, sponsored by Senator Janae Shamp, proposed making doctors or healthcare professionals personally liable for the cost of procedures to reverse a person's transition within 25 years. A person could bring a civil lawsuit against a doctor before they turn 26 years old. As to Senate Bill 1586, Hobbs added in her veto letter that medical malpractice laws already give patients the right to sue related to matters of informed consent. Shamp said in a statement that Hobbs and other Democrats were ignoring harms to children in order to satisfy their extreme ideological lust. Republicans will not stand for this callousness and endorsement of de facto child abuse, said Shamp, Republican of Surprise. We will continue to fight on behalf of our precious sons and daughters until these inhumane and ungodly practices are abolished. Hobbs had already this year vetoed several other bills that were condemned by the LGBTQ plus community, making good on a promise that dates to her 2022 campaign for governor. Hobbs has supported the community symbolically by annually draping large pride flags from her office tower, and in policy, such as making gender-affirming surgery available to state employees in 2023. The next article is entitled, Gilbert Teen Found Responsible for Fire in Barn Arson Case. A 16-year-old who police accused of starting a fire that burned down a barn full of teenagers was found responsible for all six counts in Maricopa County Juvenile Court on May 14th. County prosecutors accused the boy of being responsible for arson of an occupied structure, criminal damage, and four counts of endangerment with risk of imminent death. Juvenile Court Commissioner Keelan Bodo said she found the Gilbert teenager had violated the law from the stand during a 30-minute hearing. Earlier in court proceedings, Bodo said the case was the most serious she had ever presided over in juvenile court. For the last 5 months, both county prosecutors and the teenager's defense attorney spent more than 70 hours building their case, wrapping up their presentations earlier in the week. Gilbert police arrested the teenager after he threw a mortar firework that exploded in front of Jenny and Brandon Jones's barn in the Morrison Ranch neighborhood on July 3rd. Police said he lobbed a large explosive firework at the barn, burning it to the ground in minutes that night. The Arizona Republic does not generally name minors suspected of crimes unless they are charged as adults. Jenny and Brandon Jones greeted the ruling with relief. Jenny Jones told the Arizona Republic she felt a sense of validation and justice after spending months sitting in court hearings. The delinquent teenager's family declined to comment after the judge's ruling. The boy testified earlier in May that his friend handed him a lit firework and he lobbed it in the direction of the barn because he feared it would go off in his hand and severely injure him. He testified he never planned to harm anyone. Our next article is entitled, House Committee Passes Tax Cut Plan, written by Riley Began. House Republicans advanced elements of President Donald Trump's sweeping budget package on May 14th after a debate that lasted through the night as a key committee voted along party lines to approve tax cuts that would add trillions of dollars to the national debt. The 26-19 vote by the Tax Writing Ways and Means Committee amounts to an initial victory for Republicans, who still have many hurdles to clear before they can get the package of tax cuts, spending hikes, and safety net reductions to Trump's desk to sign into law. The vote came after an all-night debate that saw at least one lawmaker fall asleep at his post. Multiple news outlets identified the lawmaker as Representative Blake Moore, Republican of Utah. Republicans rejected a series of proposed changes by Democrats, who blasted the bill as a wasteful giveaway to the wealthy that would shred health and food benefits for the poor and worsen the nation's financial standing. So here we are. One big, beautiful tax cut for billionaires. The Republican pathology with tax cuts for wealthy people continues, said Representative Richard Neal, Democrat of Massachusetts, the top Democrat on the committee. The bill would make the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act permanent, increase the standard deduction, increase the child tax credit, temporarily create a tax deduction for tips and overtime through 2028, and implement an additional $4,000 tax deduction for seniors, among other proposals. Republicans highlighted the provisions in the bill that would help working-class Americans. Representative Kevin Hern, Republican of Oklahoma, highlighted the likelihood that billionaires would not significantly benefit from the tax breaks on tipped income, overtime, and child tax credit. While we're talking specifically here about the tax rate staying permanent, all these other provisions that we put in there that President Trump has talked about taking that they're wanting to demagogue, these other ones do direct hundreds of billions of dollars to the lower end of the income scale that they don't want to allude to, he said. Meanwhile, the House Energy and Commerce Committee was already debating a Republican proposal to tighten eligibility for the Medicaid health plan, which covers 71 million low-income Americans. That would save the federal government $715 billion and kick 7.7 million people off the program, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. As the hearing began, protesters began chanting, "No cuts to Medicaid." They were escorted out of the hearing room, and 26 people were arrested for crowding, obstructing, and incommoding, according to Capitol Police. Republican members argued that they are trying to eliminate waste and fraud from the system in order to protect it for those who really need it. Among the changes would be work requirements for adults enrolled under the 2010 Medicaid expansion and more frequent eligibility checks. Medicaid was created to provide health care for Americans who otherwise could not support themselves. But Democrats expanded the program far beyond this core mission, said Representative Brett Guthrie, Republican of Kentucky, the committee chair. Democrats highlighted the stories of people on Medicaid who could lose coverage under the proposal. They argue that Republicans had produced a bill that would cut coverage, even though they have in the past claimed such cuts would not happen. For months, Republicans told the American people that their budget would not cut Medicaid, said Representative Nanette Barragán, Democrat of California. That's not true, and today they continue to say it. Don't believe it. Republicans said Democrats were the ones lying during the hearing by highlighting the stories of children and people with disabilities, which Republicans argued would not be impacted by the proposed changes. I have a young daughter, and if she was on Medicaid and we were at risk of taking that away from her, I would share that fear, said Representative Dan Crenshaw, Republican of Texas. The problem with this narrative is that there's no reason to have that fear. A third panel, the House Agriculture Committee, was due to resume May 14th to debate proposed changes to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP, or food stamps, which provides food assistance to around 42 million Americans. The Republican plan would implement new work requirements for people ages 55 to 64, require states to provide more funding for the program for the first time, cap reimbursement to states for administrative costs, limit SNAP eligibility to citizens and lawful permanent residents, and prevent future presidential administrations from increasing benefits without congressional approval. Like the changes to Medicaid, House Republicans argued that the proposal not only provides savings that can be used for Trump's tax cuts, but also implements necessary reforms. Our reconciliation instructions provide the opportunity to restore integrity to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, to make sure that this essential program works for the most vulnerable and functions as Congress intended, said Representative Glenn Thompson, Republican of Pennsylvania, chairman of the committee. The proposals could force people off of the program as states may restrict their programs without the continued federal funding. Democrats on the panel argued that the cuts would force low-income people to go hungry in order to benefit the wealthy through tax breaks. Representative Angie Craig, Democrat of Minnesota, the committee's ranking member, said the average SNAP benefit is around $6 per day. And here's the deeper truth. Access to food is not a privilege, Craig said. The next article is entitled, Pregnant Immigrants Warily Eye Court Case, written by Christina Cook. Every time Barbara, a 35-year-old asylum seeker from Cuba, goes to her prenatal appointments in Louisville, Kentucky, one topic looms large among the other pregnant immigrants she talks to there. Will their babies be born U.S. citizens? Barbara, who asked to be identified by her first name only for fear of retaliation, crossed the U.S.-Mexico border with her family in 2022 and filed for asylum. A lawyer in Cuba, she said she fled political and religious persecution in her home country. She, her husband, and four-year-old daughter have pending U.S. asylum applications and lack permanent immigration status. The baby is due in July. an executive order issued by President Donald Trump in January that would limit automatic U.S. birthright citizenship, part of his wide-ranging immigration crackdown, would deny citizenship to their expected child if it goes into effect. Three federal judges issued nationwide injunctions blocking the policy, finding that it likely violated citizenship language in the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment in challenges brought by Democratic attorneys general from 22 states, as well as various individual pregnant immigrants and advocacy groups. The U.S. Supreme Court on May 15th is set to hear arguments in the Trump administration's request that the justices allow broad enforcement of the directive by narrowing the scope of the injunctions. Trump signed the order on his first day back in the White House, directing federal agencies to refuse to recognize the citizenship of U.S.-born children who do not have at least one parent who is an American citizen or lawful permanent resident. That night, Barbara barely slept, she said. Hearing that news provoked a horrible stress in me that still follows me to this day, she said. If allowed to stand, Trump's order would deny citizenship to more than 150,000 children born annually in the United States, the state attorneys general said in February. About 3.6 million babies were born in the United States in 2024, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. At the Supreme Court, the administration has targeted only the nationwide scope of the injunctions, content to leave them in place to protect just the people who sued, as well as the residents of the 22 states, assuming the justices find that these states have the required legal standing to bring their cases. That outcome would let Trump's order take effect in the 28 states that did not sue, including Kentucky, aside from any plaintiffs living in those states. And the Supreme Court could act without assessing the legality of Trump's directive. The 14th Amendment, ratified in 1868, long has been understood to confer citizenship to almost everyone born in the United States. The Trump administration has argued that automatic birthright citizenship does not reflect the best reading of the 14th Amendment, and it encourages birth tourism by expectant mothers traveling to the United States to give birth and secure citizenship for their children. For asylum seekers like Barbara, or those from countries with no embassies in the United States, the stakes are particularly high, advocates said. If her daughter is born with no claim to U.S. citizenship, Barbara said, she worries her child would be stateless. Seeking Cuban nationality is not an option, she said, because we came here fleeing the regime. And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.